Hello. Hi. I'm Joe, teaching pastor here. Excited to talk to you tonight. We are going to do an offering now. If you are an offering taker upper person, that's an official serving title here. Come on down, and as the satchels, bags, whatever they are, come your way, feel free to give at this time. If this is your place, your community, your church, it's an act of worship and sacrifice to give to the good things God is doing here. If you're visiting, don't worry about it. If you visit long enough, you're part of us, then you can give. Sound like a good deal? Sound like a good deal? All right, thanks. Just quit talking about the offering. We're in this play series, which is really about engaging and getting our whole self kind of into the game. Very authentically excited for what I have to say tonight. It's an interesting thing when you talk to a bunch of people. So there's lots of good things that you can talk about, and as a pastor, there's a ton of Bible stories, a ton of lessons to be learned, and every time you speak, it's just normal. It's not always something that you're super passionate about, except in the grand scope of things, that we need to be very well-rounded people, and we've got to cover a bunch of topics and look at a bunch of things and learn how to grow together. But there's a couple times a year, I think, that you get to talk about something that is just a little more personal to you, and tonight is that for me. So I'm going to be telling, actually, a bit of my own story throughout this teaching time. Sometimes that really bothers me when people tell a lot of their own story. It can feel egotistical, and it makes me a little uncomfortable because the reality is I have a big ego. And so I never know if I'm doing it for the right reasons or not. But I love to tell the parts of my story that are failures, because I figure that helps with the whole ego thing a little bit. But it's also where I've had the greatest learnings. And as we look at PLAY, this acronym, personality, learnings, abilities, yearnings, the best way we learn anything is by failing. The second best way we learn is by doing something and succeeding. And generally the worst way you can learn anything is just listening to somebody tell you something. So I'm going to tell you something here for about 30 minutes, which probably isn't going to work unless you go do something and fail. That would be best case scenario, because you'd learn a ton. Or succeed, which is fine. You learn something doing that too. We're also looking at the story of Esther. I'll be talking about that here in just a little bit. But let me tell you a little bit of my story. And I've been around here a while, and I've told parts of it here and there. And I grew up here in Ohio. I was born in Kentucky. I've admitted that to you before. We can move on. When I was 12, 13 years old, moved to Columbus, Ohio. There's a football team there that I root for. I don't know if you ever hear about them when the other guy speaks. But they're playing right now, which explains why there's less of you. When I was 18, I moved to Cincinnati, went to Cincinnati Christian University, and I wanted to be a pastor. Specifically, I wanted to be a church planter. I wanted to start a new church. And for a bunch of good reasons and a bunch of weird reasons, I was also sort of a Pharisee, and I grew up very religious and had a ton of baggage around that I didn't know was baggage yet. But I wanted to do something great for God. I wanted to make a difference and felt a call to be a pastor since I was about 12 or 13 years old, maybe even younger. And I didn't have to have a huge career decision. I knew that's what I wanted to do. Went to Cincinnati, got a degree in Bible and theology, and immediately went out to Las Vegas. Because one of the things I realized as a 22-year-old, I don't know a lot, but I know I don't want to live in Ohio. That's one thing I know for sure. And there was an opportunity to go to New York City and another opportunity to go to Las Vegas, and they both sounded very exciting. The one in Las Vegas paid $12,000 a year, and the one in New York paid zero. So I went for the money. I went for the 12 grand, and went out to Las Vegas and worked at a young church there. It was a time, it was a very fun time to be in Vegas. It was the fastest growing city in America for about 10 years. It was the last boom town in America. It was the Southwest. It was the desert. It was Sin City, and a great place to be a pastor. And I loved it because I felt free from all this Ohio Bible Belt restraint. And I still love Vegas. I often say that Vegas was like my first girlfriend that I totally fell head over heels in love with. She was just bad for me after a while. And I settled down with Cincinnati. And it was the right thing to do. It was smart. But I'd be lying if I didn't say I missed her a little bit. Cincinnati understands. I started a church. I wanted to start a church because, like most 23-year-olds, I realized everyone else was doing everything wrong. And I was going to do it right. I was going to do church the right way. And I started one, and it was immediately pretty successful. We grew from 0 to 600 people in a couple years. The average age of our church was 24 years old, which was my age. We had elders. Elders means old people. The Bible says churches should have those. And our oldest elder was 29, Jim, and our youngest was 21. And what I know now that I didn't know then was that the way God made me was to serve the church. He gave me a passion for the church. He gave me certain abilities that work really well in front of the church. But he didn't make me to work at a church 60 hours a week. And at that point in my life, he didn't make me work at a church 60 hours a week forever. I just had an unsettled torment in me, and I just felt like I wasn't in the right place. Everything around me looked like it was okay and it was successful. And as a young pastor, I made some rash decisions and did nothing incredibly unethical, but managed to grow my church from 600 to 100 in a year. That's not good. And I was depressed clinically. And I was getting into my late 20s. I had always been the person that was ahead of the game. That was my thing. I had always been 5-10 years ahead of everyone. I bought my first house when I was 22. Got married when I was 21. Career-wise, I was always ahead. And suddenly, I fell behind. I remember when I turned 30, I had quit the church. And I didn't have a job, really. And I didn't have a house, really. Luckily, I married a saint, and I had an awesome wife and two kids. But for the guy who had always been ahead, when I turned 30, I didn't really have anything. It was about that time that my wife got me a gift for Christmas. We were still living in Vegas, and we went to see The Second City, which is a comedy, improv, troupe show. Any of you know The Second City? Heard of them? It's based in Chicago, which is called the Second City because it was at one point the second biggest city or something. But the Second City is a comedy troupe, and that's where a lot of Saturday Night Live folks come out of. And it's about improvisation. It teaches you to do improv comedy, which is just making up scenes on the spot. I had always been a performer, and I'd always wanted deep down to be a professional performer, but felt like God had called me to the church. And I was at this time in my life where I didn't know what else to do. And my wife saw that I was depressed, and she was one of the few people who knew that this was one of the desires that I had had since I was a kid. And so she enrolled me in these comedy classes without asking for my Christmas gift. She regretted it several times in the 20 years to follow, 15 years to follow. But for me, it was like a religious experience, and it saved my life, really, literally. Without stumbling into that Second City improv class, I honestly believe I would have spiraled into terrible depression that would have probably, I don't know that it would have ended my life, but it would have certainly ended my faith and put me on track to being an irreversibly miserable person. I showed up at that class the first day, and nobody knew who I was, which, if you've ever been in that situation, can be one of the greatest gifts God can ever give you. Nobody knew I was a pastor. Nobody knew my story. I was just another guy in Las Vegas taking an improv class in this old dance studio that had mirrors all around it. And it's also where they stored a lot of the Vegas showgirl stuff. So all above these mirrors were these feathers and weird costumes and stuff. And there's about 12 other people in there. And I walk in, and the instructor looked at all of us, and he said, "I don't know why you're here. I don't really care. But when you walk into this room, this is all that matters. Look around. These are the only people in your world for the next hour. Nothing else matters except this when we're here. Because this won't work unless you're here. You have to be right here with me. You can't be thinking about what happened yesterday, and you can't be thinking about where you're going tomorrow. If you want this exercise to work that you're paying money for, you have to be present right here with me right now." And I'd probably heard that at times in my life before, but I was very much ready for it. And what's interesting is the same thing is true if you want to take your faith seriously. I had been working and working and working as a Christian and trying to be a Christian, but my whole focus was always on the past and the future, always. I didn't see how my faith related to now. It was about what God had done for me in the past and what now I would do for him in the future. And the now, the present, wasn't part of my life. No wonder I was a mess. No wonder I was depressed. And so I found, if you will, God at my improv class because I was too busy for him trying to build a church. And in those moments, I discovered what it's actually like to be present here right now. And I began to believe, I began to see what I would now be able to put into words many years later, that, hang with me here, the past has already happened. Raise your hand if you get confused. The future hasn't happened yet. Tracking? So they're not real. They're not here. They're not present. The past is technically our remembrance of what happened. How do you trust your memory? You're probably a little off on everything that ever happened to you. It's okay. The future is our best projection of what we think will happen. You're wrong. You're wrong. Something weird will mess up your projections. You have no idea what the future holds, and I would go so far as to say you're not very clear actually what already happened to you either. They're a mirage. You can never go there. Unless you're Michael J. Fox in the 80s, you just can't. You can't get there. This is it. This is it. Your life is a series of this. This moment, and it's gone. It's all that's real. And the sum total of your life, I have come to believe, are the choices you make right now. Right now. Right now. This is it. When you hang it up, the sum total of what will be remembered about you are the choices you made in the now. And every moment of your life that you spent now trying to live in the past and trying to live in the future will not be remembered about you. Only now. And it goes more than that. Only the moments that you say yes to now will be what make you who you are. In that improv class, the next thing they taught me after being present about 5 minutes later is they said, "We're going to tell you the most important word in improv. Here it is. It's yes. You're going to say yes in this class to everything that happens to you. You are not allowed to say the word no. They would literally berate you if you said the word no. You were not allowed to say it in beginning level improvisation. We're learning how to do scenes. That's what improv was. So it would be like scenes from a movie with no script. So someone would walk into a scene, they'd be my partner, and they'd say, "Doctor, there's a problem." I have to say yes. I have to say, yes, I'm a doctor, and yes, there's a problem. If I say, I'm not a doctor, I'm a Dalmatian dog, and there's no problem, life is great. They call that an incredibly boring comedy scene. Comedy comes in truth. It comes in accepting, no matter how weird it is, the moment. So I have to say, yes, there's a problem. And the third thing I would love for you to know about that first class of improv is they said you have to be present, you have to say yes, and you don't just say yes, you say yes and. You say yes to what someone says to you, and then you say and. So I say, yes, nurse, that's an and. I just said who that person was. Yes, nurse, there is a problem. I forgot my lunch. It's a huge problem. We'll find out why when she speaks. I had no idea when I was learning the basics of comedy that I was learning exactly what I needed to know to pull out of my pit, to find God again. And I've lived every day of my life as best as I can since then with a yes and sort of attitude. And I can't say it's easy. I would tell you it's actually been very hard this particular calendar year for me to be present. I'm really struggling with living in the future. And the irony of all that is, for me right now, you can make a strong argument, this is the best year of my life. Things are going eerily well for me. And what that does for me is it makes me worry about when I'm going to lose it. So I spend a ton of my hours trying to live in the future and keep it. But it doesn't work. The other weird part about this job, you get to tell people things that you can't always do yourself. But I try. Because what I've learned is this is it. To quote some famous philosopher, this is your moment, this is your now. Was that Kelly Clarkson or who was that? It's a pop song. Nobody know? Somebody knows. All right. This is your now, this is your moment. This is it. That's all there is. We looked at the story of Esther. Charlie started it last week in chapter 1, just to review. It starts off, this is a time, roughly the 400s BC, when the people of Israel, the Jews, have been dispersed out of Jerusalem, and they're living in these various communities, yearning for a day when they can come back together as a nation. And in this particular story, there was a king named Xerxes, who Charlie referenced would be like Donald Trump. He was a bit about himself, and he was a very wealthy guy, and he threw a huge party because he was wealthy and all about himself for 180 days, had a big party. Everyone came, and they loved the king. And it says, what it often says in the Bibles that we skip in Sunday school, which is he got really drunk, had a ton of wine, and was having a heck of a night. And he asked for his queen, Vashti, to come and to do a little runway show for him. And so, like any man, he's proud of this queen. She's beautiful, and he wants to show everyone, look what I got. And he treats her as a trophy. And he asks her to get all dolled up and to come into this party and show everyone how beautiful she is so that the world will know how awesome he is, that he can get such a beautiful woman. And Vashti does the unthinkable. She says, no, buzz off, you drunk jerk. That part's not in there. If you look closely in the Bible, you will find these amazing moments where misogynists are put in their place, and this is one of them. And she just says no. And the king's infuriated. He calls. It seems like it's the same night, so he's still drunk. He has like all of his drunk wise men come in, and there's nothing better than a bunch of guys who are all drunk trying to figure out what to do with a woman. And they all get together and they say, what are we going to do about this? And they say, this is terrible, king. What will happen is every husband in the entire empire will be in trouble because their wives won't do everything they tell them to do anymore. Once they found out that the queen doesn't do what the king says, how will we get women to stay in their place? She needs to be stripped of her queenhood, if that's a word. And he says, that's a brilliant idea. And he fires her as queen. I don't know how that works. He wakes up the next day a little hungover and is still upset with her. How dare she do that? And he's made an example so that every woman will obey their husband. And the wise men come back to her and they say, well, there's a job opening for queen, so what are we going to do? And they basically start what's the first reality show. Kind of like Hunger Games without the violence. They get women from every little place in the empire to come together and do a beauty pageant. And they're going to walk in front of the king. And the king's going to decide which one he ultimately likes the most. And that will be the new queen. So they come in, you're fired, whatever. And they just keep, they're going to do this kind of competition. And there's an advisor to the king named Mordecai. He's a Jew. And Mordecai is a very wise man. Charlie compared him to Morgan Freeman last week. I love that. Can't do an impersonation. And Mordecai sees an opportunity here. This is where I really want to try to see what this story is telling us about our moments. Mordecai sees this is a moment. This is happening right now. I could be consumed with the past about all the terrible things that have happened to our people. I could be worried about the future and how we're going to get out of this mess. Or I could be present right now. The king's looking for a new queen. What does this mean for me? Well, he has a daughter. She's an adopted daughter. His cousin had died. And he took this girl, raised her as his own. Her name's Esther. And it says that she was beautiful in form, lovely, smoking hot, right? So he knows what he's got, a lovely daughter. It's about time for her to find a husband anyway. And he goes to her and he says, this is what we're going to do. You're going to be part of this sort of ridiculous parade. Because this is an opportunity to use what God has given you for us, for our people. And she says yes. She says yes. We're telling her story today because she said yes. We're telling that story today because Mordecai in that moment said yes. This is what's happening. This is the now. This is what we do. She goes into a full year of beauty treatments, 6 months of myrrh. I don't know what that means. 6 months of cosmetics. She's a Maybelline girl or whatever. She's not brought before the queen or the king until she has 12 months of beauty treatment. And all of the girls are treated this way. Ultimately, Xerxes' heart and passion goes to Esther. Mordecai says, don't tell him you're a Jew. It'll mess everything up. No matter what, don't tell him. He accepts her within the harem and ultimately makes her queen. Right after she's appointed queen, Mordecai hears these two guards, the king, that stand by the door, arguing and talking to one another about how much they hate Xerxes, and he uncovers a plot to kill the king. So he goes straight to Esther, his daughter, the queen, and says, these two men are going to kill the king. You need to go tell him. It will give you even more favor. And she does, and she goes, and she says, these two men are trying to kill you. You know, my adoptive father, Mordecai, wants you to know that. The king researches it, finds out it's true, and he kills him, sticks him on two poles, and hangs him out to die. And he has written down in the book of his history of his reign that Mordecai saved the day. That's the end of chapter 2. Charlie's going to jump into chapter 3 next week, but it's going to be more of the same, a lot more of the same, where there's going to be one moment where Esther has the option to say yes or no, and she's going to want to say no, and ultimately she's going to say yes. In that one moment, that one now, I, for me, those improv classes led to me realizing that I was a performer. And what I thought back then is I was never supposed to be a pastor. Like, obviously that failed, but I'm supposed to be an improviser and an actor. So I started doing that professionally and did that for several years in Las Vegas, moved to Los Angeles and did the whole acting thing there, and it was going okay. And then a church in Cincinnati, the Vineyard, called and said, would you be interested at all in coming back to being a pastor? I said, no. It was a great church, but I don't do that anymore. God's called me to this now. I just said no instinctually, which is weird because I'd been taught to say yes, but not to that. 6 months later, I was burdened by the fact that something wasn't right in my life and examined my life and realized maybe it's because I said no to that too quickly. So I emailed that church and said, hey, maybe I want to talk about this more. And they say, well, good news. Everyone on the leadership team is in Anaheim for a convention tonight. Why don't you meet them tomorrow night? It's 5 miles from my house. I was living in Costa Mesa. And said, oh. I said, yes. I went to that meeting and everything in me wanted to say no. I was afraid to get back into church work. And yet I could tell this was a time to say yes. They left. I got a phone call from a guy named Rich. I hadn't talked to him for 4 years. He was in Vegas. He runs Youth with a Mission in Vegas. And I haven't talked to him since then either, I don't think, maybe once. He called me the day after that meeting. He said, Joe, I had to track down your phone number. I had a weird dream last night. I don't know how you guys feel about this stuff. I'm just telling you what happened. I don't know how I feel about it. It happened to me. He said, I had this weird dream. Do with it what you will, but I had this dream and there were 4 fish swimming around the Pacific Ocean around Los Angeles. I was like, okay, there's probably more than that, but keep going. He said, there's like 2 bigger fish and 2 little fish, like a mom and a dad and 2 kids. I get it. I got 2 kids, whatever. I'm a little cynical. He said, the fish then like flew up out of the ocean and were flying around. I'm like, that could happen. And he says, I saw this big map of the United States and they flew like all the way over to somewhere in the Midwest. And that was it. He said, but then I saw this boat that had been dry docked. And it had been being fixed. And I saw it go back into the water as if to say a time of healing is over. And Joe, I have no idea what's going on with your life. But I feel like God's supposed to let you know that a time of healing is over for you. And if there's an opportunity somehow for you to go do something in the Midwest, you should consider it. I said, now the Midwest, is Ohio in the Midwest? I've always heard it called the industrial Midwest, which is technically different. What do you do with something like that? You say, yes, that just happened. And I ended up being a pastor here in Cincinnati. Remember the place I didn't want to live? And it was great. I had been healed. And God used me in really cool ways. For like, I was there 5 years, but the first 3 or 4 years just felt right. And then I started to feel a little bit like I did that first time. Even though everything was going great, I wasn't having a lot of fun Monday through Friday, and I just felt a weird disconnect. And there were opportunities to do more at that church than I was doing. And I said yes to that because that's what I'm supposed to say. And I remember after I said yes one night to doing more at this church, exploring a bigger leadership position, that I drove home and just felt like I shouldn't have said yes. But my whole life philosophy has been yes. I came back the next day and I said, you know what? I think no. And what I realized is that God was calling me to say yes to something else. And that's when I actually realized, I love the church. I'm good for the church. The church isn't good for me 7 days a week. God has made me to serve the church and have a job. And I started a company 3.5 years ago, which is a hard thing to say yes to when there's security if you say no. It's a hard thing to say yes to when you are facing college tuition in the face for your kids. But I had to say yes. About a year ago, I was having dinner with Sean Case, who's executive pastor here, and I've been speaking here all along, and he's like, "Oh, you're not doing church work anymore." I said, "Nope." No, I didn't. I said, "What are you thinking?" He knows me pretty well. He's been on my whole journey. He's like, "What if you could serve our church part-time? Some of the time, while you're doing this business God's called you to do." And I thought about it, but I really didn't have to because it just made so much sense. It was yes and. It was yes and. That's how I'm here. That's how I wound up here. And we're preparing to do something farther south of here to take Southbrook and expand. And I think God has called me to help with that. I said, "Yes, here I am. You're stuck with me." And unfortunately for you, I also have a job, so I might be here a long time. It's my normal church cycle's 3 years. But if I got a job, it feels right. Everything feels finally like me. But it's been a series of times when I've said yes that have made me who I am today. It's a series of these now moments. And the older you get, the more you can look back on your life and see that that's all it's been. And implied in every yes, of course, is a no. Because if I say yes to this, like, not doing that, I'm not doing that. And that's why so many of us hate to say yes or no. Because if we say yes to this, it means we made a decision. That's the worst thing ever, because now we can't do this and this and this. But there is a yes and place. There's a place in our life where we can say, yes, this is what's happening in the now. If I could somehow drive anything into your souls, it would be that the now, right now, is real. It's heaven. It's hell sometimes. I would tell you that it is my opinion that this is the message of Jesus. That God is available to you right now. Right now. By my calculation, about 90% of the time Jesus talks about heaven, he's talking about right now. If you think of heaven as in the future, you only get 10% of it. The bulk of heaven is right now. Heaven is where God is, and God is here, and he's here right now. This is the gospel. This is the message of Jesus. You are improvising your way through life with an improv God who says yes, and you say yes, and he says yes, and you say yes, and he says yes, and off you go, and you build a beautiful scene together that is your life. It's an improvisational world. And you can only do it if you're present right now. My hope for you is that you'll say yes to something right now. I don't know what it is. I'm going to lead you through a little prayer exercise that might help. I will tell you the most dangerous word, the most dangerous word you can say if you want to truly live in the now. It's soon. That's the most dangerous word. When are you going to start writing that book? Soon? When are you going to call your friend? Soon? When are you going to go back to school? Soon? When are you going to think about getting a new job? Soon? It's a lie. Soon's in the future. Future's a little squishy. You know when you can do all those things? And it be real? When? Now. It's all you got. It's all you got. Give me 3 or 4 minutes here to pray as we end, and I'd like to pray this way. If you'd be willing, close your eyes and maybe sit up straight. Put your hands, if that makes you comfortable, kind of on your legs or on your knees. I'm not going to, this is going to be a time where I'm just going to lead you through a little prayer exercise and give you the opportunity to connect with God. This is totally up to you. This is your now. This is your moment. You can listen to me and do this, or you can choose not to and think about the past or the future. If you do that, I've totally failed. But it's not about me. Be present, be now. God, we invite you into this moment. We know that you're already here. Just notice what's going on with your body. If you feel, you can move your head around or your shoulders if you feel tight, and you can take a deep breath. You just need to relax here for a second. What gives us so much anxiety and tension is the past and the future, and this is not that. We accept that and hold all we have, which is right now with God. The promise of Jesus that God is with you right now. Try to be aware of the presence of God. If you think about something from your past or something that could happen in the future, just acknowledge it, dismiss it. Send it off. All I'm going to do now is just ask that God would give you a word or an image in your mind that will be related to what he wants you to do now. Talked about soon being a bad idea, but for this exercise, let us define now for the next 24 hours. Don't judge it. Don't think about it. Just take note of the first thing you think after I ask you this question. What should you do now? What can you do now? What does God want for you now? Right now. Take note of it. Hold it. This is a precious gift. Whatever this word or image is, it may not make sense. You get to hold it with you as you go. It's all you have. God, we thank you. We love you. We thank you for being the God of the now. Give us the courage to do what you've asked us to do. Amen. We can stay reflective here in this room. If you want to take communion on your way out, you're welcome to do that. Why don't we remain in silence, take communion if you want to. Once you get to the lobby, you can have fun and ride the horse or whatever they got out there for you. All right. Have a good week.